This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Here's just a taste of the heavy hitters in this week's program.
The planet itself would stop absorbing carbon dioxide overall by about 2070. And after that, the planet would begin to emit carbon dioxide. That's the point at which you've crossed that threshold. And even if we stopped all human emissions of carbon dioxide, the planet itself would be releasing carbon dioxide because it's so damaged. And that's when you're into the realms of runaway or irreversible climate change. So as I say, that turning point was assumed in that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report to be round about 2040. The work that I've done shows that it actually happened in 2006. It happened 10 years ago.
That's Professor James Curran from Scotland. Formerly the head of the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, Curran has published new science. It shakes our planning for climate change to the core. The plants, it seems, are soaking up less and less of the carbon dioxide we pump into the sky. Peak carbon is not later in this century, as predicted, but behind us. It's stunning news that makes climate action so much more urgent than you've been told. Then,
once fossil fuel consumption changes, it will also change the distribution of power. And I think this is the central anxiety that actually prevents countries like the United States and Australia and so on from moving on climate change. It's not about lifestyles in the end. I think it's really about who gets to, as it were, run the world system.
You will hear from one of India's best-known authors in both fiction and nonfiction. Amitav Ghosh has just released his newest book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. In a wide-ranging interview, we look at climate change from the other side of the world. In the news, climate scientists are already at work analyzing the role of climate change in deadly Hurricane Matthew. It was the strongest storm to hit the Caribbean and America's East Coast in a decade. The seas there were about 3 degrees or more hotter than usual. That gave it energy. And then the warmer atmosphere was overloaded with extra water vapor. We'll await the postmortem. In this program, Amitav Ghosh does talk about the modern migration of humans to the sea coasts, just at the time when perhaps that becomes the most dangerous place to be. Unreported, except in the Siberian Times, scientists have found still more methane leaking from frozen deposits on the shallow seabeds of the East Russian Arctic. Professor Igor Semilyatov of Tomsk Polytechnic University returned on a Russian research ship. He found significantly more methane escaping than measured on earlier trips from 2011 to 2014. The methane amounts are not yet at a panic level, but it is at a danger sign from one of the most likely sources of a rapid climate shift. A big methane burst could power rapid global warming. Thanks to our guest scientist Paul Beckwith for that tip. In a new report, The Truth About Climate Change, top-level scientists say that the 2-degree danger mark we've all been looking at has moved forward in time, from the end of this century to 2050. As Ian Johnson writes in The Independent, quote, "It means the majority of people alive today will experience what it is like to live on a dangerously overheated planet," end quote. I think we're there already. I'll try to find out more on that for you. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get to our interviews. Most of the land on Earth is in the Northern Hemisphere. What if all the plants there started to capture less and less carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Surely that couldn't happen. Our guest was the chief executive for the Scottish Environment Protection Agency, or SEPA. Now James Curran is co-author of a new study published in the journal Weather. The title is An Estimate of the Climate Change Significance of the Decline in the Northern Hemisphere's Uptake of Carbon Dioxide in Biomass. It's not good news. Professor James Curran, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
Let's talk about your new paper. How can we possibly know how much carbon dioxide the totality of plant life in the Northern Hemisphere can inhale, so to speak?
Well, it's interesting. And as you said in your introduction, I recently retired as chief executive of the Scottish Environment Protection Agency. But for a while before that, I'd been thinking about how to set about looking at the way the atmosphere is responding to basically vegetation, the terrestrial vegetation. And I was very keen as soon as I retired to take a look at it. If you look at the records of atmospheric carbon dioxide that are measured at the summit of the Mauna Loa mountain in Hawaii, that's the Mauna Loa Observatory, where daily measurements are made, and they're all available online, so anyone can look at these. And if you look at them, carbon dioxide, obviously, as we well know, has been increasing steadily year by year since the measurements at that site began in 1957. Now, that's a particularly good site because it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's high up on a mountain near the equator, way, way, long way away from any other kind of land masses. So you get a very good representative sample of planetary carbon dioxide there. As I say, it's been increasing steadily year by year. But if you look at the detail of that, what it does is the carbon dioxide increases during the Northern Hemisphere winter and then decreases during the Northern Hemisphere summer. So there's a kind of little ripple, an annual ripple in that rising trend. That ripple is because, as you said yourself, most of the landmass of the Earth is in the Northern Hemisphere. During the summer, the leaves come out on the bushes and the trees. Trees grow bigger. Crops, even our own human crops, grow. And all of those suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in order to increase the amount of plant mass, the biomass, as it's called, in all the ecosystems across the Northern Hemisphere. As we approach Northern Hemisphere winter, it's very obvious the leaves fall off the trees, they land on the ground, and then they begin to decay. And as that plant matter decays, it releases carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So during the Northern Hemisphere winter, planetary carbon dioxide levels increase again. So by studying this little ripple in the Mauna Loa observatories, this ripple that occurs every year, summer to winter, you can then begin to estimate how much the biosphere, specifically in the Northern Hemisphere, but that's the greatest part of the Earth's biosphere, is reacting over the time period of all those measurements being available, which is 1957 right up to the present.
And what did you find?
Well, that was interesting. I mean, first of all, I was a meteorologist originally and moved gradually into the environment. So I was pretty sure when I decided I'd really love to look at this that someone else would have already done that study. Turns out a couple of people did it many, many years ago, but they were looking at it for other reasons and didn't have this particular test in mind. So I looked at it, and what I found is that that drop in planetary atmospheric carbon dioxide, which happens every Northern Hemisphere summer, has gradually changed. Now, originally in the kind of 1960s and 1970s, that drop in the Northern Hemisphere summer was getting bigger. That's because it has been fairly well kind of assumed and understood that as you put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from man-made activities, and as the Earth slightly warms, then vegetation actually gets more active because carbon dioxide is a kind of fertilizer to vegetation. And it did. So that drop, showing the activity of the Northern Hemisphere biosphere, increased over the kind of 1960s, 1970s. But interestingly, that activity, that biomass activity, peaked in 2006 and has slightly dropped since then. So we've gone beyond this kind of peak carbon absorption, this peak ability of the planet to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. Now, that is really, really scary.
And you say it dropped slightly. How would that compare to human emissions, say, from countries?
Okay, well, this is a little bit complicated, and maybe I'm not awfully good at explaining it, but I'll do my best. During the 60s and 70s, the Earth was getting better and better at sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So as man-made emissions were increasing then, the Earth was sucking a bit more carbon dioxide each year out of the atmosphere and locking it up in tree trunks, in the soil, because plants put a lot of carbon down into the soils and so on, and taking it out of the atmosphere, locking it away safely and pretty permanently. as I say, that ability has now peaked and is beginning to decline. And if it had gone on increasing as it did year by year in the 60s and 70s, we'd be in a much, much better position now because the Earth would be more efficient at slowing down climate change, at slowing down the rate at which carbon dioxide is accumulating the atmosphere because of all of our polluting activities. That decreasing ability is exactly equivalent to us having actually added on, without us really realizing it, 30% of human man-made emissions. That's equivalent to adding on another China in terms of emissions. So the end result is that atmospheric carbon dioxide is now increasing as fast as if we'd added in another China compared to what it would have if the biomass hadn't been beginning to fail. That's a huge impact. And it explains something that has been a little bit of a mystery recently, that atmospheric carbon dioxide is increasing faster than ever at the moment on planet Earth at a time when we're just beginning to get a grip on man-made emissions. And over the last kind of 2 or 3 years, man-made emissions have begun just about to flatline after having risen year after year after year. And that's been a bit of a mystery. Why is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rising faster than ever, but our own emissions are more or less beginning to stabilize? And I think it's because of this, because the planet is beginning to fail to take carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and lock it up.
I've had oceanographers say the same thing, that they feel that the oceans are reaching their limit and they won't be able to absorb the greenhouse gases that they have been doing. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch we're talking about here.
Nice way of putting it, 1-2 punch, absolutely. I mean, none of this is kind of brand new. What made me start thinking about this, many years ago, I was asked by the UK government to be an independent reviewer of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when they produced their assessment report number 4. That was back in 2007. There's been an update since then. And buried in the thousands of pages of that, I think, absolutely brilliant report was a little graph that showed the kind of modeled, anticipated behavior of all the terrestrial ecosystems of the planet in their ability to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And what that modeling did, and out of that you then predict what's going to happen to planetary carbon dioxide, it was suggested that the ability of the ecosystems to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere would be at a peak round about 2070. It would then begin to decline because ecosystems get hit by climate change. It gets too hot for lots of plants to survive. There's lots of droughts and floods that damage natural vegetation as well as crops. There's wildfires, and we hear more and more about those, which destroy the plants, also can set fire to high carbon soils, peatlands and so on, releasing carbon dioxide. Numerous of these kind of positive feedback effects. These would kick in from 2070 onwards. The planet itself would stop absorbing carbon dioxide overall by about 2070. And after that, the planet would begin to emit carbon dioxide. And that's the point at which you've crossed that threshold. And even if we stopped all human emissions of carbon dioxide, the planet itself would be releasing carbon dioxide because it's so damaged. And that's when you're into the realms of runaway or irreversible climate change. So as I say, that turning point was assumed in that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report to be round about 2040. The work that I've done shows that it actually happened in 2006. It happened 10 years ago. So we've really got to take that very, very seriously and do everything we can, not just to reduce our man-made emissions, but actually to try and repair the broken planet, to get biodiversity functioning again, to get our biomass up, to get ecosystems functioning as they should.
Well, one small question. My listeners in Australia and New Zealand will wonder why the study isn't global, including the Southern Hemisphere.
It's because if you look at those data from the Mauna Loa Observatory, it is the northern hemisphere that's absolutely dominating. It's that produces this ripple in the carbon dioxide values year on year. It's because, as you said yourself, the vast amount of land, and particularly productive vegetated land, is in the northern hemisphere. There's not so much land in the southern hemisphere, and quite a bit of it, like Central Australia, I haven't been there, but I believe, and I've seen pictures of it, it's fairly desert, so it's not very active at taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That's the reason.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Scottish professor James Curran. He's found that plants are taking in less carbon dioxide in recent years, and in fact, as we've just heard, we may be looking in the rearview mirror at peak carbon. Well, except for being frozen in permafrost, isn't most of the carbon captured by plant life eventually released back into the air, as you said?
Well, no. I mean, the plants are very effective at clearly increasing their own biomass. The trunks of trees get bigger as they grow. They put more branches on and so on. So there's more and more carbon being taken up in the plant itself. But an awful lot of carbon is fed down through the roots and is sequestered or locked up in the soils through many kind of carbon-based chemicals that are left in the soil. So soils accumulate carbon. The plant material itself accumulates carbon. The kind of volatile bit is predominantly the leaves that fall off in the winter, lie on the land surface, the soil surface, and then decay, biodegrade, releasing carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So an awful lot of the plant material pretty kind of permanently sequesters carbon away, certainly on the kind of timescales that we're thinking of, which is hopefully hundreds or thousands of years. But eventually, a lot of it will end up forming peat deposits, and I'm speaking from Scotland, where we have enormous peat deposits. Our kind of iconic heather moorlands are all based on peat deposits underneath that can be many feet deep, and in Scotland, that peat resource actually holds billions of tons of carbon in the peat. And that's quite an interesting example of potential climate feedback, because Scotland is kind of, I suppose, semi-notorious for having a cold, wet climate, and that's why peat is created. Climate change would suggest that in Scotland we're going to get warmer, and in the summer, drier. That is very, very damaging to peat bogs if they dry out, and in fact, the peat breaks up, it cracks open, air gets in, and it begins to decay and release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So it's those kind of processes that we need to worry about, that climate change feedback, climate change causing perturbations to our ecosystems that then themselves start releasing carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. So climate change worsening climate change itself.
Yes, peat fires should cause us all to break into a bit of a sweat. There were peat fires outside of Moscow in the Russian 2010 fires, and the 1997-98 peat fires in Indonesia took that country to be, I think it was the second or third largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, just from the peat fires that they had.
That's right. I mean, another worrying aspect of climate change feedback. We hear more and more about wildfires. Even in Alaska, there's been some quite big wildfires recently which burn off the vegetation and then can get actually into the high carbon soils underneath, and the soils burn for a long, long time afterwards, as you rightly say, releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that's taken hundreds, if not thousands of years to build up.
Well, you've talked about getting this cycle going again so that we can capture carbon with plants. We've all heard about plans to stimulate plankton growth as a way to increase carbon capture. Professor Curran, given the scale of nature's operations, do you think we'll find ways to reverse the decline in plant capture?
Well, I sincerely hope so. I mean, through my professional life, I've sat on numerous kind of biodiversity committees here in Scotland, trying to either stabilize biodiversity or hopefully reverse the decline and start rebuilding biodiversity. Scotland kind of cares about the environment quite deeply. We have a government that produces all the right kind of statutory documents and strategic plans and so on. But it really, really, with the best will in the world, doesn't seem to be working awfully well. There's a well-known approach all around the world in many, many countries to designate particular sites and particular habitats and protect them, or to designate particular species and try and look after them. There's loads of green and environmental NGOs that work endlessly protecting particular interests and so on. But yeah, thinking about that approach, it's quite fragmented, isn't it? Lots of goodwill, lots of enthusiasm, but it's fragmented. And it really, at the end of the day, just doesn't seem to be working. Biodiversity around the world, and even here in Scotland, at best is in some places kind of stable, at worst in many places is declining. So I think we probably need to begin to think about completely different approaches. And again, this isn't brand new thinking, but there's accumulating evidence, some really good scientific studies, that if you start joining up what remains of natural habitats or semi-natural habitats with corridors, you connect them with managed corridors so that species can translocate and move around and so on, then you begin to get a real resurgence in biodiversity. And I think we've got to begin to look at really strategic, big scale, landscape scale, national scale, strategic rebuilding of corridors between the wild parts of that we have remaining. I'd love to see us experiment with that here in Scotland. I think by chance we have a very good opportunity to connect up two of our biggest national parks with corridors joining up our natural or semi-natural habitats. And allied to that, you know, there's a growing concept of rewilding the landscape, allowing it to become more the kind of natural vegetation, the assemblage of species and plants and so on that would occur under more natural circumstances. And that, again, bolsters the ability of those ecosystems to absorb carbon. It improves their sequestration capability for carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So I think we've really got to start thinking much bigger and change our policy and legislative approach to how we try and preserve. And now we certainly need to rebuild biodiversity right across the planet.
Part of that plant life is agriculture, and if we change some of our means of agriculture so that we don't lose so much carbon from the soil, and in fact put some back in the soil, I think that's another hope for us.
Oh, you're dead right about that. There's lots of implications potentially for the way we manage our agriculture. Agriculture, certainly here in Europe, is highly subsidized with a lot of state aid, and I think that state aid needs to be increasingly directed to low carbon agriculture, kind of zero tillage agriculture. If you just plow up huge areas of land to plant crops in, it's very damaging. That releases a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Whereas if you do zero tillage, you just plant the individual crop plants into the soil, you don't do wide-scale plowing, then immediately you can save a lot on carbon releases. So there's lots of way agriculture and farmers can very positively contribute to making us all safe from climate change in the future. And I think that'll have to come. That is already beginning, but we need to accelerate it and be much more ambitious in that regard.
I think it's going to be difficult to get your new science out to the general public, and that's partly because the news is pretty awful to believe. What happens if the decline continues?
Well, as I say, it's very worrying if that decline goes on continuing, and I would certainly hope that many others start looking at some of these aspects and doing different experiments looking at this issue of declining ecosystem ability to lock up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We need to look at it from different ways, doing different experiments to try and substantiate it, to put a scale on it, and through that to identify the ways that we can intervene and hopefully reverse this positive feedback element to climate change. If we don't, then we are headed for accelerating carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Our own efforts to minimize man-made emissions, which are, you know, there's been great progress there. The COP21 agreement in Paris is about to become now the single greatest global treaty that man has ever managed. I mean, that's something to be hugely proud of. But potentially, that's in the face of another adverse impact that is going on that we haven't really been aware of. So we need to really, really up our game when it comes to implementing the Paris Agreement and up our game when it comes to protecting our planetary ecosystems. If not, we are facing, as I said earlier, the potential for irreversible climate change, which is hugely damaging to us, to man. We don't know what we'll be facing. And anyone who believes in the precautionary principle, as I do, would not want to go anywhere near that kind of trigger point.
Well, in the news, Scottish Environment Secretary Rosanna Cunningham has urged the UK government to sign the Paris Climate Agreement. Do you personally really think the Paris Agreement can keep global warming below 2 degrees C?
I believe that there is an opportunity. I think the Paris Agreement is a huge breakthrough. I attended the Copenhagen summit along with a ministerial delegation from Scotland, and I was so devastated at the failure of that conference to come to any useful agreement. This one in Paris, I only watched on the TV, and I'll be honest, I was crying when it was finally agreed. I think it's a huge breakthrough, down to French diplomatic genius, I think. So the opportunity is there. What we've now got to do through programs such as yourselves is bring the message home to people that Paris Agreement is the door. It's the doorway to a better future. We've got to walk through that doorway now and take every opportunity to reverse the journey we've been on since the Industrial Revolution.
Professor Curran, what is next for you now?
What's next for me? As I said, I get quite excited about some of these big projects. I've spent a lot of my life thinking about climate change and also thinking about sustainable development. What I want to do is to try and get some momentum and some motivation behind a possible project here in Scotland to create a strategic joining up of our ecosystems right up the centre of Scotland. I'm proud that Scottish Government has some of the leading climate change mitigation legislation anywhere in the world, a 42% reduction in man-made emissions in Scotland by 2020. We've met that target 6 years early because the latest data are for 2014. So we're exceeding the target. Scottish Government is putting in place even more stretching targets for reducing our man-made emissions by 2020 and beyond. I'd like to see my country trying to take a lead in rewilding and reconnection of our ecosystems and habitats here in Scotland. And I think we could do it, and I want to be part of that if I can.
I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Professor James Curran, the former head of the Environment Agency, SEPA, in Scotland. And now with Sun Samuel, James has investigated the big picture of carbon capture by plants in the Northern Hemisphere. It is declining dangerously. Find links to the full paper and to James Curran in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. James Curran, I've enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
And you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Heating up a small planet affects everyone, everywhere, no matter who releases the greenhouse gases. I'm always looking for voices outside the bubble of the Western-style consumer culture. Our next guest was born in the Indian megacity of Calcutta. He studied at the Delhi School of Economics and got his PhD at Oxford. Currently, when he has settled anywhere, Amitav Ghosh lives in New York. But Ghosh is most widely known for his writing. His best-selling novels make him one of the souls of India. His mastery of fiction and non-fiction make him a bridge to English readers as well. Here's a powerful introduction of Amitav Ghosh, recorded at the launch of his new book, The Great Derangement. It was in his birthplace of Calcutta.
I am Jagushini. Amitabh Ghosh is the author of such acclaimed fiction as The Circle of Reason, which was, of course, his debut novel, The Shadow Lines, The Calcutta Chromosome, The Glass Palace, The Hungry Tide, and the Ibis trilogy, Sea of Poppies, River of Smoke, and Flood of Fire. His notable non-fiction writings are In an Antique Land, Dancing in Cambodia and at Large in Burma, Countdown, and The Imam and the Indian. In The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, which is Amitabh's first major book of non-fiction since In an Antique Land, he examines our inability at the level of literature, history, and politics to grasp the scale and violence of climate change. The climate crisis asks us to imagine other forms of human existence, a task to which fiction, Amitabh argues, is the best suited of all cultural forms. His book serves as a great writer's summons to confront the most urgent task of our time.
That recording is from the book launch August 1st, 2016 in Calcutta. On YouTube, you can find the whole thought-provoking conversation between Amitabh Ghosh and filmmaker Srijit Mukherjee. And I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.info so you can find it.
Radio EcoShock.
Amitabh Ghosh, it's an honor to have you join us on Radio EcoShock. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I listen to your show all the time. I have the podcast downloaded on my phone, so this is really an honor for me.
Well, I'm really surprised, and I'm really pleased, of course. And it is a good source of climate science news, I think. Now, to get going here, I was in Mumbai back in 1979, when it was still called by its colonial name of Bombay. And since then, you know, the population has doubled to almost 21 million in Metro Mumbai today. Tell us about the risks of climate change to this mega city.
Well, Mumbai is in an extraordinarily vulnerable location, you know, because it's just completely exposed to the sea. It's built on these reclaimed islands. So most of Mumbai is actually, you know, built on reclaimed land now. South Mumbai was, initially just a set of islands, and they've now been linked together. The real problem for Mumbai is two things. One is sea level rise, of course. But the other major problem for Mumbai is that cyclonic activity is increasing greatly in the Arabian Sea. In the past, Bombay, Portuguese Bombay, as well as British Bombay, the city was hit by cyclones fairly regularly. This didn't happen in the 20th century, but it seems that now with the uptick in cyclonic activity in the Arabian Sea, that Mumbai may well be hit in the years to come.
And you've suggested buildings could collapse in the city.
Buildings collapse in Mumbai, as you know, also in other Indian cities and other Asian cities. Buildings collapse anyway. It happens fairly often. And these buildings are not built to resist extraordinary wind speeds or anything of that kind. So, yes, I think if Mumbai were to face a storm like Hurricane Matthew, the results would be completely catastrophic.
And is the city prepared if a storm like Hurricane Sandy hit it?
Not at all. The city is not prepared at all. I went through all the disaster preparation documents that the city has produced. The disaster that Mumbai is preparing for is actually yesterday's disaster, as it were, you know, which was this terrible, this extreme rainfall event that occurred in 2005. When, you know, the city got something like 36 inches of rain in 14 hours. And there were terrible floods after that and so on. So after that, you know, the city government did try to take cognizance of what had happened, and they've tried to create some documents around it. But that sort of event and a major cyclone would be completely different in their impact.
And Mumbai has a nuclear power plant on either side of it, and I'm worried that a terrible event like the meltdowns in Fukushima, Japan, could happen in India. I mean, all that has to happen is the power grid goes down for long enough, their batteries run out, they can't get their diesel fuel through, and those things can melt down. Is that a genuine fear?
It's certainly a fear for me. It's a fear for me. It's a fear for others who study nuclear safety issues. In a sense, one doesn't want to be excessively alarmist because, as you know, it sort of makes people's minds shut down. So I don't want to sort of be raising a hue and cry about that, but it's certainly a very, very, it's a possibility. It's something that could happen.
Well, this sort of dovetails into your book title. You've said that climate change is to some degree unthinkable.
I think, yes, climate change is unthinkable according to the manners and procedures of thought that we've developed over the last 200 years. It resists our ways of thinking in many different ways. But equally unthinkable are the sorts of responses it requires from us, you know, managed retreat, changing our lives, changing the ways in which we deal with our ordinary circumstances. Everything in our life, in our collective lives, is really interrogated and questioned and challenged by climate change in a way that has never happened in any other circumstance, I think.
And you recently returned from Chennai on the east coast of India. Tell us about the extreme rainfall event that struck there.
There again, there was this extreme, what they now call a rain bomb. So there was this sort of rain bomb event, suddenly, you know, a stalled system dumping huge quantities of water on Chennai. The problem for India, of course, is that not just India, but many places in the world, is that human impact and climate impact have both accumulated to the point where really they're both exacerbating each other, you know. So in Chennai, actually, many of the activists don't even really want to talk about the climate change impact because, you know, they're so focused on criticizing the political structures in the city, on focusing on its patterns of development, very misdirected development, where they've built over drainage channels, clogged up, you know, old rivers and creeks and the wetlands. So, you know, in some strange way, because people are focused on that, and they should be focused on that, they sometimes don't even want to hear about the climate change impact. Another problem really in relation to India is that, you know, well, not just in relation to India, as you know, really climate science, the whole discourse around climate change tends to be very, very Eurocentric. It's almost completely focused on the West. So attribution studies, for example, really haven't paid much attention to Asia and or other parts of the world. There's been no attribution study, so far as I know, of this rain bomb event in Chennai or even the event that occurred in Mumbai in 2005.
Have the city planners and the developers changed their ways in Chennai to avoid a repeat?
On the contrary, you know, just at the time that I was releasing my book in Chennai, somebody told me this astonishing fact that a developer has just announced a super luxury condominium building, actually in one of the most vulnerable spots. It's at the mouth of a river and, you know, a few hundred yards from the sea. And this super luxury condo is going to have a 7-story basement. What can you say, really? I mean, it's just another symptom of the derangement that we live in.
It is a kind of madness. You know, whether it's Chennai or Miami Beach or New Jersey, after every flood, people and, of course, the politicians promise to rebuild everything exactly in the same dangerous places. How can we go on living in this dream, knowing what we do know from the science of climate change?
It completely boggles the mind, really. I mean, just today, I was reading in a journal article Dutch engineers talking about Miami, and the word they all used for Miami is doomed. At the same time, you know, some part of my screen, there was an ad going off for this super luxury building on Miami Beach. And people are apparently buying into these buildings. They are making investments in these properties. What can you say? It's really a metaphor for the strange state of mind that we're all in.
And yet, you think literature has somewhat turned away from climate change?
Yes, I think literature has. And that's really what my new book is about. It's about the ways in which climate change really resists the literary forms and even the artistic forms of our time, you know. Because basically these forms were invented in the 19th century, in the early 20th and the mid-20th centuries, when we lived through a period of relative climatic stability. And now, you know, we are in this moment when, you know, the climate is anything but stable. And our forms just haven't caught up. Our forms haven't even begun to catch up. I'll give you an example, if you like.
Please.
I was in Mumbai, again, talking about my book. And I was speaking to a couple, they're very famous artists, very famous, very successful, globally successful artists. And they were telling me about their experiences during the deluge of 2005. Their house was swamped. They lost a lot of work. Their child was stranded and they couldn't reach her for 2 days. So it was a traumatic experience for them, you know, in every sense of trauma. And I asked them, I said, so has this trauma in any way found its way into your work? Have you expressed it in your work? And they were both astonished by the question. I mean, not only had they not addressed this trauma, those floods in their work, the very thought hadn't occurred to them. And the real reason for this is that, you know, if an artist of that stature addresses something like that, then it's considered illustrative. You know, it's considered to be an illustration, if you like, of surroundings or whatever. And that illustration is now a real pejorative in the vocabulary of art criticism. And if this pejorative had been applied to their work, they would have lost their market. Their work would not have been taken seriously from that point on. So do you see what I'm saying? We have reached a point where really our art, the very mode of our art, refused to let us engage with our surroundings.
A serious situation. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is the legendary author Amitav Ghosh with his new book, The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. In your book, you trace your own beginning path to climate awareness to a strange weather event in Delhi. Tell us about that.
Yes. Let me say straight away that weather event had no connection to climate change that I know of. This happened in 1978. So a long time ago, it was a day of very strange weather in Delhi University. I was a student there. I was also working as a journalist. I was in a library. And, you know, the weather was so strange. Suddenly there was a hailstorm and it stopped. So I decided to go back to the room that I was living in. And I took a very unusual route, a route that I didn't usually take because I wanted to just stop by and see a friend. And the weather kept getting worse. So then I sort of headed off. And as I was walking down a road, I glanced over my shoulder and I saw this strange sort of like a finger reaching down from the sky. And as I was watching, it sort of came whiplashing down to earth, behind me on this road. So I ran for cover. I first went to this big plate glass door. There were many people cowering there and there was no room for me. So then I went around to the side and I sort of took shelter under an overhang. After a while, there was this incredible noise. I looked up and I saw things just whirling through the sky, you know, tea stalls, bicycles, asbestos roofs, because there were a lot of asbestos roofs in Delhi in those days. And it just lasted a moment and then it was over. And it was, of course, a tornado. But a tornado had never before struck Delhi. Tornadoes are completely unfamiliar in that part of the world. So, you know, none of us even knew what to call it. The next day, in the newspapers, it was called a cyclone, in fact, because nobody knew the right word for it. But it killed 30 people. Many of the people who were around me were injured. So I was extraordinarily fortunate. But I've written about this in the book because what I was trying to address is this idea of the unprecedented, you know, the unfamiliar, the uncanny. Because just think about it. There I was walking down a street and suddenly a completely unprecedented, historically unprecedented phenomenon suddenly touches down right on top of me almost, you know. And for years afterwards, I tried to write about it, but it's very unlikeliness. The very nature of the phenomenon was such that I couldn't actually bring myself to put it into a book. Because you know how in novels it's often said that if you put this in a book, nobody would believe it. And that's actually the case, that the sort of whole calculus of probability that exists in contemporary fiction is such that even ordinarily unlikely events become very difficult to put into a book because they just seem so improbable. And in my book, the argument that I make is that it's this calculus of probability that is in itself one of the factors about climate change that resists the techniques of the modern novel.
And you read a lot of science for your 2004 fiction book, The Hungry Tide. What was that book about?
Well, the book is about, the book is set in the Sundarbans, the vast mangrove forest in India. It's actually in Bengal, and I am myself by origin a Bengali. And I spent a lot of time in this forest, even as a child, because one of my uncles worked in it. And I've been returning to it over the years. So my book, The Hungry Tide, is actually about an Indian-American cephalologist, specialist on marine mammals, a young girl who's doing research for her PhD. And she goes to the Sundarban to study the Irrawaddy dolphin, you know, which is it's a freshwater dolphin, though some members also live in saltwater. So she goes there and she encounters, again, a cyclone. This is a very cyclone-prone region. So, that's the general background.
An awe-inspiring part of your thoughts, I think, on climate involves a still larger pattern of populations all over the world moving towards the seas at the exact time in history when that is a very dangerous place to be, the interface between the seas and the land. Why do you think that migration away from the inland agricultural lands happened?
Well, one of the obvious reasons, of course, is the intensification of trade. And the argument that I make in the book is that if you look at, say, pre-17th century cities, even the major ports were not built directly on the sea. I mean, like London, for example, you know, it's separated from the sea by a long stretch of the River Thames. That's true of Guangzhou. It's true of many of major port cities, ancient port cities of Asia. Really, the whole trend of building cities right on the sea starts under the European expansion that begins, you know, the 16th century onwards. And many of the cities that are now most threatened were actually built in the 17th century. So, for example, New York and Mumbai come into the possession of the British Empire in the 1660s. And these are both cities that are now directly threatened by climate change. But again, you have in the 19th century another major wave of city building. Again, many cities were built right on the water in this period. In the U.S., of course, you have Chicago, then there's Singapore, Hong Kong, many other cities are like that. And these cities, again, are today extremely at risk from sea level rise. So in the book, I'm just sort of tracing these patterns of how is it that at a certain point in time, people suddenly decide that it's a good idea to live close to the sea. And as we see now, you know, this pattern is actually accelerating. More and more people are moving closer and closer to the sea. And the consequences in the long run are certainly going to be disastrous.
Yes, I'm told that about 50% of the American population now live within 100 miles of either the Atlantic or the Pacific coast. Well, Amitav, we've talked a lot about rising seas and storms, but global warming does mean global warming. And just this summer, India experienced its hottest temperature ever recorded. What is the threat of heat to India?
It's enormous. I mean, the temperatures this summer were unprecedented. I mean, like 51 degrees centigrade, you know, not far from Delhi. Delhi and, cities near Calcutta experienced temperatures of 47 to 49 degrees centigrade. These are temperatures in the 120s in Fahrenheit, temperatures at which really people can't be exposed to the sun for more than 15, 20 minutes without becoming completely dehydrated. But there are two things that are very interesting about these heat waves. One is that, of course, the heat wave also coincided with this epic drought, where hundreds of thousands of farmers from certain interior regions in India started abandoning their lands and moving to cities. Literally, in a very short period, millions of farmers left their land and moved to the cities. You know, what we don't realize about these migrations is that when a traditional farmer, someone who's farmed all their lives and who knows by observing their fathers and their grandfathers and grandmothers, farming the land, they learn all these techniques. So when they move away, really we lose a huge amount of agricultural knowledge. And this knowledge can never be restored. Those people will probably now settle in the cities. They'll never go back to their farmlands. And, you know, a huge trove of knowledge is lost. And this is something that's happening not just in India, but also in the U.S. You know, last year I was invited to the University of Indiana, you know, to talk about my books and so on. But I had some very interesting interactions with the students there. Now, as you know, the University of Indiana was originally an agricultural institution with a great focus on agriculture. And many of the students are from rural Indiana. And I was talking to them and I said, so what do you guys want to do in the future? How many of you are from a farming background? And many of them, maybe more than half, were from farming backgrounds. So I asked them, what do you want to do in the future? And all of them, literally all of them said, we want to move to New York, you know. So if this gigantic migration takes place and continues to accelerate, I think we're looking at a circumstance where really who's going to be left to produce the food?
Monsanto.
Monsanto. That's exactly it. You know, there's a huge sort of hemorrhaging of human capital and human knowledge that's occurring and that we are not paying attention to. The other thing which really struck me about the heat wave in India, I was in Delhi, very shortly after the heat wave, and I had a meeting with some young journalists. There were 30 or 40 very bright young journalists there. And we were talking, about climate change and so on. And I asked them, I said, how many of you wrote about the heat wave? And, you know, a couple of them had, written short pieces about the temperatures. But there were no other stories. You know, none of them had written any sort of long-form story. None of them had, even gone out and reported about it. And I think that is really the problem. How do you write a story, even just a journalistic story, about a heat wave? What's your story? How do you put people in it? And this is where I think really, the arts are failing us. Literature is failing us. If the great literary minds of our time can't think of these stories, how can you expect, busy, rushed young journalists to go out and tell these stories?
Amitav Ghosh, you don't think highly of the climate agreement reached in Paris in late 2015. Why not?
Well, in the first place, there are multiple reasons. I don't think it's actually going to achieve the goals that it claims to. But anyway, I'm not an expert on that. I think to me there are two things which are really profoundly disappointing about this agreement. One is that it makes literally almost no mention of climate justice. There's only one sentence in it where climate justice is obscurely referred to, and it's sort of parenthesized as something which is of interest only to a few. As we know, justice is absolutely a central issue in climate change, and it has, in effect, what this Paris Agreement achieved was to sweep the whole issue of justice under the carpet. So that is really one major problem as far as I'm concerned. The second major problem is that nowhere in the document do they even speak of climate change as a market failure, which actually occurs in the Kyoto Protocol and in earlier iterations of these agreements. But here it's completely absent. So there's no question here. Never is the question confronted that should we change our lifestyles? Do we need to think about our ways of living in new and alternative forms? Those questions are never broached. They're never addressed. In fact, what this Paris Agreement does, in my view, is that it's a direct descendant of, all these other free trade agreements like TARP and NAFTA and so on. It deploys exactly the same language. And what it's aimed at is really, it's aimed at creating business opportunities around climate change. So in a way, what it is that it's a neoliberalization of climate change. And I think, that's not going to help or work in the long run.
I think we'll still go well over 2 degrees with that, if that's our best hope. And speaking of hope, do you think there is hope for us?
That's the question that actually I've heard you asking many of the scientists that you interview, and I think they're much better placed to address it than I am. But one thing I've certainly noticed is that, you know, where on the question of hope, the answers that you usually get from climate scientists and so on is geared actually to politics more than to actuality, as it were. I mean, there are people who feel that if you present a sort of panicky view of what's ahead, then that's unfruitful. On the other hand, there are people who feel that unless you raise the alarm, people won't respond. As far as I can see, neither of these approaches has worked.
Yes, well, you call it the Great Derangement, so obviously you're quite concerned.
Yes, of course. But I really admire activists like Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, and so on, and I really admire the work they do, and I try and support it in whatever way, but I don't think of myself as an activist.
Well, I think writing is an activist act, and certainly you'll communicate with millions of people with your new book. As we end our time together, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
But first, I think one of the most important things I'm trying to say in the book is that, you know, the whole sort of climate issue has been increasingly sort of conceptualized as a matter of wealth, you know. People don't want to sacrifice their wealth. That's why they deny climate change and so on. This is a position that you'll hear many activists take. But I think what is even more important than wealth in this matter is actually power. What underlies the global distribution of power today is fossil fuels in many ways. And once fossil fuel consumption changes, it will also change the distribution of power. And I think this is the central anxiety that actually prevents countries like the United States and Australia and so on from moving on climate change. It's not about lifestyles in the end. I think it's really about who gets to, as it were, run the world system.
The fiction and nonfiction works of Amitav Ghosh are read by many millions of people. His latest is a deeply thought-out look at the inner and outer perils of climate change. It's called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. You can find out more at amitavghosh.com or find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. If I may just point out, the book is published in the U.S. by the University of Chicago Press.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Be sure to check out my website at ecoshock.org for all our past programs. You can download those shows with some of the world's top scientists, authors, and activists, all for free, thanks to support from our listeners. Please take the opportunity to get educated about our future and the ways to save it. The Radio EcoShock weekly blog is also there with loads of links to everything we've talked about. You can check out the sources for yourself and explore the big questions. Don't miss it at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world. This is a compilation of the song Brand New Sky from soilforclimate.org.
There is life all around me under a breath.